You're listening to Policy Currents, a weekly podcast from RAND. I'm Evan Banks.
And I'm Deanna Lee. Every Friday, we bring you new insights from RAND's latest research and commentary. It's April 26th.
Last Friday morning, Israel conducted a retaliatory strike against Iran, targeting an airbase in the central part of the country. The response came less than a week after Tehran launched a barrage of missiles and drones at Israel, and in spite of strong urging from the United States and others that Israel refrain from striking back. Although the strike appears to have been largely symbolic, the decision still raises an important question, says RAND's Raphael Cohen. Why is Israel bucking its allies yet again, especially after those very countries just helped it intercept incoming Iranian missiles? Cohen starts with what he calls the bad reasons that have been cited to explain Israel's calculus. For example, some say that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants war with Iran in order to restore his image domestically, or at the very least, to prolong the political reckoning he might face after Hamas's October 7th attacks. In other words, Netanyahu may be acting, at least in part, to increase his chances of political survival. Another more basic motive that has been floated is revenge. But in general, emotional decisions do not make for a prudent strategy, Cohen says. And that's particularly true in this case, given the military and diplomatic stakes for Israel and the Middle East as a whole, should a regional war break out. So what's the real reason why Israel struck back? Israel and Iran are at war. This has mostly been a covert war for years, but since October 7th, the conflict has come out of the shadows. The common denominator between Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and other groups that have attacked Israel for more than 6 months now is that they are all, to varying degrees, funded, trained, and equipped by Iran. Israel and Iran will likely continue to trade blows, even as the United States and other allies counsel Israel to avoid escalation. Cohen concludes that Washington's best chance at preventing this simmering conflict from turning into an all-out war in the Middle East may be to convince Iran to rein in Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and other proxies, and to do something about its burgeoning nuclear program. Otherwise, the conflict between Israel and Iran will only continue to spiral.
Earlier this year, the Food and Drug Administration granted accelerated approval for a drug called Leqembi, a new treatment for Alzheimer's disease. However, shortly after that announcement, the largest insurer in the country, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, said it wouldn't cover this treatment for Medicare patients until it received full FDA approval. And even then, only for patients who meet certain criteria. This is far from the only example of insurers refusing to cover breakthrough drugs. And according to RAND's Zachary Predmore, the main reason why some health insurers prevent patients from accessing these new drugs is cost. Quote, insurers resent that drug companies can charge full price for a treatment that may or may not work. Predmore notes that while it's not wrong for CMS and other insurers to be cautious and selective about making drugs accessible to patients, there is an alternative to refusing coverage altogether. Insurers could condition the price they pay for a certain drug on the treatment's ability to achieve specific outcomes, including outcomes that are important to patients. For example, if a drug like Leqembi was unable to slow or prevent Alzheimer's to a measurable extent, then the drug's manufacturer would then have to pay back a portion of its profits to the insurer. This would effectively lower the price of the drug and leave manufacturers on the hook for the high costs of ineffective drugs. This is just one way the medical establishment can prioritize listening to patients. When it comes to treatment options, patients weigh risks against potential benefits differently than government agencies do. And that's especially true for patients with diseases like Alzheimer's, for which there are few therapeutic options. If treatments have a chance of working, then patients should have affordable access to them. Even if some of those treatments are later proved to be less effective than previously thought. As long as patients are fully informed, Predmore says, the choice should lie with them.
Political instability, armed conflict, human rights abuses, and poverty have plagued the Democratic Republic of the Congo for decades. A core part of the Congo's ongoing crisis is the battle over the country's vast natural resources. For example, the Congo is home to two-thirds of the world's cobalt, a mineral that's essential to producing green energy technology, such as batteries for electric cars. A boom in industrial-scale cobalt mining has led to mass forced evictions and human rights abuses as mining companies force entire communities from their homes and farmland. Some have compared labor practices in the cobalt industry to modern-day slavery, as various multinational companies reportedly source some of their cobalt from freelancers for penny wages. Chinese companies are increasingly cited for this practice after acquisitions in the past decade allowed them to supplant a generation of American ownership of cobalt mines in the Congo. According to RAND's Marie Jones, more must be done to provide transparency into the cobalt supply chain in Congo by examining labor practices, environmental degradation, and gaps in investment into local infrastructure. Another important focus area is understanding the extent to which Chinese and other international companies are bound by Congolese government oversight and regulation of the mining industry, or the extent to which they circumvent such protections through corruption. There's also a need for economic policy changes that address the lack of employment opportunities in the Congo. Workers need alternatives to artisanal mining, but at the same time, artisanal mining must be made safer given that it's an economic lifeline for some. And finally, more research is needed into how the governments of consumer nations can implement recycling to recover critical metals like cobalt from used devices. Jones says that a combination of research and international engagement could help to set the Congo on a path toward stability and resilience.
As lessons from the pandemic continue to emerge, a new RAND study focuses on a group that's often overlooked in discussions about the effects of COVID-19, the 1.2 million incarcerated adults in U.S. federal and state prisons. More specifically, our researchers conducted an analysis to understand the pandemic's impacts on state prison education programs. Here's just a sampling of the findings. COVID negatively affected instructional quality early on in the pandemic. 90% of state correctional education directors who we surveyed reported short or long-term gaps in instruction and an inability to administer assessments. Halting and/or suspending in-person instruction has continued well beyond the first year of the pandemic. In fact, as late as 2023, instruction continued to be interrupted in different prison facilities because of new outbreaks of COVID and staff shortages exacerbated by the pandemic. At the height of the pandemic, about 49% of administrators of Second Chance Pell, a program that provides incarcerated people with access to federal Pell grants for undergraduate education, reported that COVID led to college instruction being canceled, and about 41% reported a reduction in the number of college courses that could be offered. Further, the pandemic caused delays in the financial aid application and in the enrollment processes for Second Chance Pell, as well as reductions in the number of students who could enroll in the program and who applied for the program. It's not surprising that COVID had considerable and lasting negative effects on correctional education systems, and it remains to be seen whether prison education will fully recover. However, the authors do note some bright spots, namely the adoption of educational technology and preparation for future pandemics.
That's it for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today, check out the show notes at rand.org/podcast. We'll see you next week. RAND is a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis.